Good morning, everyone. How does this, is this loud enough? Does this seem like it's on?
It's good.
It seems like it's okay?
Yeah, that's good.
If it gets too loud or too soft, just let me know. Welcome to you. Do you need to say anything, Sharon? She's gonna close the doors.
As the door closes.
Yeah.
So noise doesn't get in the way when people come by.
Right. So, good to see everybody on our second day here of the week and some new folks that arrived on the boat yesterday. And some people leaving today. Ted and Glenn are leaving at noon or so. So, let me just review a little bit about what we talked about yesterday. So these are the topics that we're looking at each week. And kind of giving a big picture, but also sort of a local and immediate kind of view of the Christian story. And yesterday we tried to get a sense of how ancient and vast God's story is. This universe has been around for about 13.7 billion years. That's a long time that God has been creating and engaging and loving and forgiving and inspiring and working with this vast universe. And our particular solar system's been around for about 4.6 billion years. And life has been here for about 3.8 billion years. And that's a pretty short time when you... or pretty long time when you think about it. Multiple cell life has been here for about 660 million years. Land life, about 395 million years. We covered this more in depth yesterday. We're going pretty quick through this, but given a sense of how ancient God's story is, dinosaurs and mammals for about 295 million years, and reptiles, I mean, mammals, small mammals, for about 195 million years, larger for 60 million years. And our species, Homo sapiens, only about 200,000 years. And to give a little sense of how short a time we've been here, if life started here about 3.8 billion years and we've been here this long, if you were to take your laptop and hit the hyphen button, and each time that was 200,000 years, you would have to hit that 19,000 times. That's how long life has been here on Earth. And we've been here for one of those. And who knows if we'll be here for the next. But it kind of gives you a sense in God's ancient story. We're time-wise a tiny piece. Does that tell us anything? Does that affect how we understand God, how we understand our place in this universe, how we understand the Christian story? Maybe too. And we left with this question. If God's story is so ancient and so vast, these are pretty brand new religions. These are babies in this story. And I kind of left you with a couple of questions. What do you think prompted these religions to emerge at this time? Now, if you're a person who has a hard time conceiving that there is a God, the question might be, what was going on in human cultures that sort of inspired the emergence of these religions? Or if you're a person who does believe in God, which I think most of us would be in that camp, the question might be, well, why did God act at that time? After so many years, even so many years for our particular species. And the other question was, why do these religions seem to be about us and addressed to us. So let's just pause right there. Anybody do some thinking about those questions since yesterday? Have some insights, some thoughts about that? Yes?
Mammals aren't asking the questions about God.
What mammals?
Reptiles and non-Homo sapiens.
Do we know that?
No.
Yes.
It feels like probably something shifted or wasn't working.
Mm.
And so that these religions perhaps arose in some sort of response to some sort of unfulfilled question or I don't know.
Yes. I have always thought about it in terms of us being at a place in terms of development where we're able, not, I won't say to begin hearing the voice of God, but being able to relate that or record that or in some way share that.
Yes.
But these religions didn't grow out of nothing. They have roots in ancient traditions before them. Mm-hmm. And so they are on a spectrum of human contemplation. Mm-hmm. And that's something we are rooted in other, Judaism takes some of its things from other mm-hmm. religions. Mm-hmm. And so, and certainly around the world, God has been at least a subject for human contemplation all around the world
yeah.
with ancient traditions.
Okay. Well, I have to say that I don't know the answer to these questions, but have a theory that I'm going to share here today. And it might be a way of looking at things that you've thought about long before I have and are way ahead of me on this. Or it might be a way of looking at things that really kind of shake your foundations a bit. Know that this is just something that I'm proposing for you to think about. If it makes sense and kind of gets you thinking in new ways, that's good. If it seems totally crazy, just brush it off like dandruff. Don't feel that this is the final word. But here's Ron's theory of why these religions, which had roots in many other places, emerged at this time. And I, as a person of faith, would say that God was sort of the one who planted the seeds of these religions, who prompted these religions and inspired them. And that is, before we get into that, our prayer.
Lord, gather us in prayer as the Pentecost season discloses itself and as we seek to fully inhabit this special mountain village, reside in the holy spaces. Alert us to your life-giving presence in, with, and under all that is seen and unseen. Teach us unreservedly and grant us the courage to act upon what we learn. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Okay. So, here's the thought. It is that these religions emerged because our species was beginning to regress. Not so much in terms of smarts. We're plenty smart. But in terms of intelligence, and especially in terms of wisdom. So let's just kind of break down what these words mean or how I'm using them. Smarts is the ability to get what you want. There are a lot of smart people in this world. Intelligence is being able to think on various levels and to understand nuance and to see things from other people or other creatures' perspectives. Wisdom goes even further, able to think of the long-term implications and the larger implications, and certainly ethics as a foundation of those. I'm suggesting that our species, a little bit contrary to what Scott said, had begun to regress, and that that's a recent thing. So let's just play this out a little bit. It takes a lot of smarts to make a Coca-Cola commercial. There are a lot of people who spend their whole life doing this. But the fact that we fall for this, doesn't this show a high, high, high level of low intelligence? Another more serious thing. Currently, 9 nations in this planet possess weapons of mass destruction. That means the people in those countries, including the United States, have made the decision to empower mere generals to obey orders from mere politicians to launch weapons of mass destruction. And these nations are saying, if our lifestyle is threatened, not only will we mass murder the direct people who are threatening us, but we will commit genocide and ecocide across wide swaths of God's creation for a long time to come. It takes a lot of smarts to make one of these, let alone a doomsday arsenal. But the fact that someone would do this, doesn't that kind of make you wonder about intelligence and certainly about wisdom? This particular continent, for a long, long time has been a pretty verdant place. And one of the reasons had to do with so many rivers running through and flooding year after year and bringing topsoil and just making this a rich place. And a lot of it, too, had to do with the beavers who built dams and were a whole part of that ecosystem. Well, first came the trappers, who basically decimated the beaver population for the purpose of pelts for rich people, basically, around the world. And then came the Army Corps of Engineers and other entities that were really involved in straightening rivers, among other things. And when you straighten a river, you speed up how fast it flows. And so now we have a situation where tons and tons and tons of wonderful soil is just rushing down rivers out into the sea every year. Smarts? Yeah. Wow. Intelligence? Wisdom? You kind of wonder. There are about 20 million species on this planet. Currently, about 80 species per day are going extinct because of human misbehavior. Now, 20 million is a lot, but you just wonder about intelligence and wisdom as you think about that. So, I'm suggesting that these religions emerged, and I'm suggesting that God acted in this way, addressing a situation amongst one of God's species, that was starting to go a little bit nuts and was regressing. So we're going to take a look at this a little bit. And what is the kind of the core of this regression? It perhaps could be moving from an eco-centered view of life in the world to an ego-centered view. And notice the correlation with patriarchy. From a narrative where, as humans, we are part of the whole community of life, to a narrative where the earth belongs to Homo sapiens, every square foot. It's us, it's for us. I wonder what other creatures are thinking about this. This narrative is something called human exceptionalism. It's a view that humans are special. We think we're more special than all of the creatures. In fact, we think we're more special than all of the creatures put together. It's a view that says humans are separate from the rest of creation, superior to the rest of creation. The reason for these first 13.7 billion years were just kind of getting ready for us. And the rulers of. A number of people through recent human history kind of put this into words from the 5th century BCE. Man is the measure of all things. We're the yardstick, the plumb line. We're the determining factor of what is of value and what isn't. If it is of value to us, it's good. If it's not, it's disposable. Francis Bacon, would someone like to read something he said?
Man, if we look to final causes, may be regarded as the center of the world, insomuch that if man were taken away from the world, the rest would seem to be all astray, without aim or purpose. Philosopher Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626.
John Jay was our first Supreme Court Chief Justice. He's describing the American continent this way. Would someone like to read this?
Extensive wildernesses, now scarcely known or exposed, remain yet to be cultivated, and vast lakes and rivers and waters have for ages rolled in silence and obscurity to the oceans, are yet to hear the din of industry and become subservient to commerce and boats, boast villas and gilded spires and spacious cities rising on their banks.
I'm from Arizona, and this is just sort of a recent book on water. Of course, we have water issues in Arizona. And yet we have our Arizona Corporation Commission, and some of their literature shows that they're planning to have the population triple in the next 30 years. Key to the roadmap is the understanding that the water needs and health of an ecosystem are defined within the context of human priorities. That would pretty much describe a lot of policy. Sometimes this is called human exceptionalism. Sometimes it's called anthropocentrism. Anthropos is the Greek word for human, or anthroponarcissism. friend of mine calls it diva theology. I call it humanism. And different from how we usually use that word. It's a way of saying that we think we are the center. Humanism's creed. Would someone like to read this?
Nature is a jungle, a dangerous, deficient, defiant, disorderly enemy. It is wild and needs to be tamed, broken and needs to be fixed, inept and needs to be colonized, a wasteland in need of development.
Humanism's creed, the garden was made for us, we must conquer it. Anybody know who Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary are?
First up to Mount Everest.
Yeah. Tenzing was a Nepali Sherpa. Edmund Hillary, was he from New Zealand, I think, or Australia?
Australia.
Edmund Hillary died about 10 years ago. A thing in the paper, I burst out laughing, he said, they conquered Mount Everest. Well, I've been to Nepal. I haven't been to Everest, but in the Annapurna's hiking. And I've climbed 6 of the 14ers in Colorado. Anybody done more than that? When you're on a mountain like that, you haven't conquered a thing. You're a speck. But just sort of the rhetoric of that. We conquered Mount Everest. We must rule it, we must use it as desired and discard the rest, it's expendable. I was listening to the radio, running through stations, coming home from church one Sunday, and a preacher, I think he would say he was a Christian preacher, was talking about the earth being kind of like a paper towel. Use it up and dispose it, because it's for us. Yeah. You wonder. No, it wasn't. It wasn't Lutheran.
Wow.
You wonder.
Wow.
She's treating us like a paper doll.
Yeah. Would someone like to read this last paragraph?
We should not stop our quest to command land, sea, sky, weather, wildlife, bacteria, genes, Arctic ice caps, every square inch of Earth's biosphere, until this holy mission is fulfilled and creation lies bleeding at our feet.
Ooh.
Until we have transformed both God and nature into our image.
Who said that?
Who said that?
That's from one of my books.
You said that?
It's trying to put into words what I think this human exceptionalist view has kind of going on.
That was Jamie Watts.
Yeah. And as we adopted that narrative, and I'm suggesting it's a recent adoption within our species.
Not
that people were innocent or perfect or anything earlier, but this sort of conquistador thing is a recent thing. In Tucson, so conquistador, these were mass murderers, right? We have an Elcon Mall. In 2014, I took a group of students to Haiti. Some people been to Haiti. We were working with handicapped children in an orphanage, but we learned some Haitian history. And when Columbus landed there, right, on that island, and there were about 500,000, or 500,000 native peoples. And within 30 years, it was down to about 50,000. Now, some of that had to do with disease, of course. But it also didn't help that the conquistadors cut off hands, cut off feet, cut off heads, enslaved, gathered the leaders of that island onto some kind of big building like this that they had built for supposedly a festival or something, locked the doors and set it on fire. conquistadors were not all that wonderful. We became dominators, colonizer. There's this decolonization movement. Can someone put into words sort of what that is about? Isn't it sort of, you know, planting our flag and this belongs to me? I'm reading a book on the Lewis and Clark expedition that I got in this library here. And it's a journal of Lewis and Clark. And basically, they even say our job was to basically declare our sovereignty of this land to the native peoples. And each tribe, they had to do it differently. But that was the underlying goal. And become takers. And so economics, with this new narrative, and economics is management of the oikoi, which is the household, which is sort of a big thing that includes not only just what's indoors, but the surrounding area. The ecosystem has regressed into humanism, how to get more and more stuff for ourselves, for our species. And politics, which is the art of finding the common good, has regressed into humanism or conquistadorism. Even academia, I'm surprised, and I was campus pastor for 17 years, how much students and professors and doing research and getting grants have to justify everything they do in terms of how it affects, how it benefits humans. And if you can't make that case, you're not going to get the grant. Science, which is, you know, is the wonderful exploration of this amazing world, and then figuring out a ways in a complementary way to make products and goods and services and do things that we as a species need, has regressed into humanism, or what I call scientism, and that sort of is domineering and being a conquistador and subduing and making it subservient to us. And even Christianity, and this might be a little controversial, I wonder if Christianity, too, hasn't also regressed into humanism. A mere and diminutive melodrama about how much we think God gushes over us. And the more you preach that, the larger your congregation will grow. And with your human exceptionalism, you show in a little bit of, you put in a little bit of American exceptionalism. We're the greatest nation on the face of the earth. And add into that a little bit of Christian exceptionalism, my religion's better than yours, you will have a large church. Will it be the Church of God in Christ? I'm not so sure, but it'll be large, and you'll have good donors. So that's the key to growing your church.
Well, thanks.
Yes, you got it. And there are a lot of examples of this sort of, it's all about us. Daniel Erlander, have you read his book, Manna and Mercy?
Yes.
What a wonderful book.
Yes.
He sort of put it this into these words. Would someone like to read this?
Humans decide to find joy by becoming big deals. How did humans know if they were big deals? They knew by bossing others around, by piling up stuff, by dominating nature, and by reaching glorious heights of health and beauty and knowledge. They also know by having more points than other humans in their scoring system.
And then the prophet Hosea maybe said a similar thing. Did someone read this?
Hear the word of the Lord, O people, for the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or loyalty, and no knowledge of God in the land. Swearing, lying, and murder, and stealing and adultery break out. Bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore the land mourns, and all who live in it languish, together with the wild animals and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea are perishing.
These, of course, are the buffalo. There were 75 million buffalo in North America, and you've read stories about, let's just wipe them out. So in a sense, we left the Creator's house under the permeating reign of God and instead declared our house under humanity's reign. And with this narrative came an unfolding brokenness with our human neighbors. Now again, before this happened, nobody was perfect. There was no ideal kind of time. But it certainly accelerated into brokenness with neighbor. And brokenness with nature. And even brokenness with our own inner soul and spirit and self. Kind of producing an emptiness that we try to fill with all kinds of nonsense, which doesn't leave us filled up. It makes us even emptier. And of course, out of relationship with our Creator, the ground of all that is. Paul Tillich maybe referred to this as dis-ease. Soren Kierkegaard, a sickness unto death. Paul, groaning in travail. Nancy's dad, who was a pastor, that's my wife Nancy back there. Hey, and our daughter Jen and her spouse Deb, anyway, for those who haven't met them. Nancy's dad called this existential disrepair. I like that phrase. I'm kind of using the term humanism, being out of relationship by putting ourselves at the center. Anybody read Daniel Quinn, his book Ishmael and a few others? He really got me thinking in different ways. And he talks about these stories. So he's saying this change in our species is fairly recent. In the last few thousand years. After living a couple hundred thousand years in a fairly honorable way, we began to regress. And these biblical writers are trying to address that. So this particular story, you can imagine the storytellers kind of having the experience of people kind of showing up in their community or emerging from their community, and they're kind of scratching their heads and saying, what's wrong with these people? They seem to think that they're the center of the world. At least they're acting that way, or that the world belongs to them. Maybe they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and they think they're God. You know, it's a story. It's a parable. That was maybe their attempt to try and describe what they see, this puzzling thing that's happening. Maybe it came from another region into their region, or maybe it emerged in their community. Tower of Babel, you know, let us make a name for ourselves, mm-hmm. build towers to the sky. That's a little bit of self-aggrandizement there, wouldn't you say? And Daniel Quinn does some nice things talking about this story, and he talks about Abel being generally indigenous cultures, and Cain being conquistador cultures. And whenever Cain finds Abel, Cain rises up to kill him. Even today. And it's kind of a helpful image. It's really maybe not all that the story is about, but this might be helpful as we're going forward to think of Abel as that form of being human that is sees our species as part of the whole. And Cain is that way of thinking, that worldview that sees our species as separate from, superior to, the reason for, and the rulers of. And I would suggest that Christianity and Judaism are Abel religions, but they've been taken over, and Abel of Nazareth has been turned into Cain of Nazareth. And we're going to talk about that more tomorrow, God's response to this, which is what the biblical story is. And as we adopted this narrative and began to regress in intelligence and wisdom, we were in over our heads. It's like a two-year-old trying to do laser surgery. Or me trying to fly a 747. Or a mere general and a mere politician being in charge of weapons of mass destruction. We're in over our heads. Daniel Erlander calls Genesis 6:6, very early in the Bible, the saddest verse in the Bible. Would someone like to read this?
The Lord was sorry he had made humankind on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart.
Continue.
So the Lord said, I will blot out from the earth humankind which I have created.
So it seems like, at least according to the narrative, God had a dilemma. What am I going to do with this species? In my household, there are many dwelling places. There are 20 million because there are 20 million species. And this human species, they get one of those dwelling places. But they think they own the house. With college students, in campus ministry, one of the challenges, and we maybe can remember this from our college days too, not everyone's a good roommate. In terms of dishes piling up, in terms of trash spilling out of the can, in terms of having the lights on when you're trying to sleep, or stereo turned on too loud when you're trying to study, not everyone's a good housemate. What kind of a housemate are we being? And so God had this dilemma. What should I do? Should I destroy these folks for the sake of the world? Or should I try to heal them? What would you do? Well, apparently, God decided to try to heal us. Phew. We're certainly glad about that, but I think the rest of the community life is probably glad about that too. How? That's really what the biblical story is about. It's addressed to us, for us, to try to heal us and restore us to God's larger story. One way to think about this is that God's primary mission is the unfolding story of the universe. It's been going on for a long time. 13.7 billion years is still going on. Every ecosystem and every species in the universe reads these scriptures in the form of atoms and stardust, in the form of geological layers and tree rings and ice caps and DNA. It tells a story that we read, and we as Christians kind of need to be up to speed on. But God also has taken on a secondary mission, and that's more recent, and that's to try to fix one species that's kind of gone haywire. And this secondary mission and the Bible, we're probably the only species that reads the Bible, but it's about us, and it's for us, and it records this secondary mission. I don't know if that's the right word, but this secondary thing that God is doing to try to fix us, to restore us to God's primary mission. So it's like God's primary mission has been going on for a long, long time, even with our species, but we started to leave it and kind of go off on a tangent here, and God is trying to restore us and bring us back to the household, to the community of life, to God's primary mission. And this mission, this voice is embedded in two scriptures, in nature and in the Bible. And I kind of have the heretical view that they are equal in authority and weight. And I also have the heretical view that you can't understand one without the other. So, let's kind of pause right there, and this might be things you've thought about for a long time, or it might be a little bit new to you, or what are some things rolling through your mind? Yes, Anne. Say that one more time.
Can you give an example of not understanding nature without the Bible?
An example of not understanding nature without the Bible.
You were saying that you can't understand the primary scriptures without the secondary, or the secondary without the primary.
Oh, okay. So I think the Bible, to understand, the Bible, we need to see it in the context of this larger story.
Right. But the other way around?
And the other way around, so how can, I think it has to do with who owns this. I think it makes a difference to know that God is the one who owns this world. That would be one example. Yes.
So when I think about the primary scriptures, I think about them, for at least for humans, evolving. Our primary scriptures have changed a lot, even in my lifetime, as far as our understanding the
yes.
universe and how
yeah.
it has come to be and how old it is and all of
yeah.
those things. So it's just a question about that evolution of our secondary scriptures, which are so caught in a time and so bound by human story, that might we be looking at these in different
that evolving too or changing?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and we're going to talk about this another days too, but certainly the biblical worldview is different than our worldview today. Right? Just in terms of astronomy, I don't think it was till the 1850s where it became kind of commonly accepted that those lights in the nighttime sky are stars, and that those stars are suns, and our sun is a star. Well, okay. They're not just little lights up there. They're like what ours are. And then the 1920s said it's not just our galaxy with 200 billion suns or stars or solar systems, but there are about a trillion galaxies. This is a big place. And then we talked yesterday about the invention of the microscope and the telescope. We can now use rather just our five senses. We can look at other things to see. I mean, looking at bacteria through a microscope, that's a fairly new thing. Well, what does that do to our... How do we read the scriptures when we have a different worldview from what they had when they wrote them? Even from the Reformation years. The last 500 years have been, not that we're, I don't think we're any smarter, or I don't think we're any more intelligent or wiser, but it's altered the worldview.
Yeah. It feels like part of what's important about that is that a diversity of people read the scriptures and we see different things in there. I think that's been the value of women reading scriptures and queer folks and people of color and people from other countries, that people see wisdom even in those same words that I can't see. Or I wonder if that's how they continue to evolve, is through some of our multiple perspectives. It's like Americans read the Bible differently than people in developing nations or people who are under occupation the way that the folks in the Bible.
Yeah.
Well, those secondary scriptures were not written by white people.
Right. No.
Right.
On you having said that reminds me that not everybody in the human family has contributed equally to the destruction of the system, of the ecosystem. Primarily, it grows out of that Western culture. Right now, we are seeing it through the lens of us as those consumers who are, I'm seeing it that way. I'm part of the problem. I'm part of a society that really sucks up more than its share. But not everybody in the human family has done that or is doing that. And so they have a different point of view. I was struck 2 years ago. I was in Hawaii and I went to a national park where they were explaining about some of the rules of the Hawaiian society. And one of them had to do that if you fish out of season, it was the death penalty, which sounds just so awful to us. Until one of the park rangers was saying, this has to do with living in harmony with your environment. You do not take what is not seasonally available to you. Because if you do, it'll wreck the whole system. Okay, that was, I think that those are things that I keep learning about. But this story has to do with us and that culture, that Judeo-Christian culture. There's a whole other world out there that has not been, I'm not saying they're not sinless, I don't mean that.
Right.
They haven't been contributing like we have.
So there are able cultures.
There are cultures different than ours, but here's the thing, and I would like to see, we talked about this at breakfast, part of our difficulty comes from the Bible's own words, where we took that story out of Genesis that says, you shall have dominion over the earth. And we didn't interpret that as you shall be entrusted to be a good steward. We took it as, so anyhow, I think that's important to say repeatedly. The Bible also has contributed to that.
Yeah.
But I think that goes to them being secondary scriptures too, because the translations don't always come over the way they were intended. And I think we've translated it so many times that we might have actually lost the true context of the word.
That's another class.
So the word dominion, okay? It could be that we've mistranslated that. Or it could be that those storytellers were wrong. And one way of thinking about this is the word dominion. Is that a redeemable word? In a sense, when our kids were young, Nancy and I had dominion over them. Now, if that meant helping them to come to know who they were as God's child and to grow and develop and to flourish as who they were meant to be, then that's a good thing. If it meant abuse and exploitation, then, you know, we need to be put in jail. Nancy and I have been married, we're married for 45 years. In a sense, she has dominion over me and I have dominion over her. If that means we help each other to kind of blossom into who they are meant to be, that's a good thing. If it means abuse and exploitation, then that's a bad thing. But can a good form of dominion be saved? Well, that's why we kind of looked at how tiny we are as a species. The world does not need us to have dominion over it. The world does not need us to steward it. The world would like us if we would steward our own darn selves. But the world does not need us to take care of it. It needs us to self-regulate and be responsible as a species. So we've even turned Christian stewardship into kind of a sense that, you know, we're there to help the world be the world. Yes?
As a retired chemistry professor from Pacific Lutheran University, I'd like to suggest that God having made the world is all the more reason for us trying to understand how it's put together and how best to live with it.
Yes. Yes.
So what if you've spoken of the biblical narrative as a narrative, which is a story that has a story arc, right?
Yeah.
And so what if ideas of dominion or be fruitful and multiply were parts that belong to a different part of the play, an earlier part of the play, an earlier part of the drama? And it's like when you see a Shakespeare play, you don't start repeating the very first dialogue in the fourth act. Maybe we're in a different part of the act, or a different part of the narrative, a different act. And so everything that is happening for us depends upon what came beforehand, but we don't just simply repeat the line. Maybe the dominion or be fruitful, multiply was something that was helpful, beginning of humanity's journey. But now as we read that, we need to look at that in a different way.
That's a good point.
That's along the same lines that kind of goes to the whole idea of how you study history. You have to understand history in order to not make the same mistakes again. And I think we have aspects of society now, too, that they go back and they want to, history offends them so that they feel that erasing or not keeping mm-hmm. that visible will make people more comfortable. But truly, we need to keep it there to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes and treat people the same ways. And I think that kind of goes to that whole idea of the arc. You know, that was part of what developed us to where we are and how we progress. I think that ties
that's
in.
Yes?
I think one of the modern parables about dominion is the Lion King. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When Mufasa rules and he rules for the benefit of the whole land and mm-hmm. all the animals, even though there's the cycle of life, everything is abundant and fertile, mm-hmm. they have a good life. And Scar takes over and it's all about him and his cronies, everything goes to pot. Mm-hmm. And then when Simba takes over again at the end of the movie or the story, things are back in balance. Mm-hmm. It's how the king exercises dominion. Mm-hmm. Is it by him or is it for the good of all?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the difference between use and abuse. Mm-hmm. We needed the use, make everything useful, but then we abused it and subjugated it, or whatever the word is. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
One of the abuses I see is consistently we have a new fad, and everybody has to do that fad. And that was okay until we ran out of whatever it was we were fadding and spoiled it. And now there are so many of us. I've had teachers talk about how much better off the earth would be if we did not be on it. And it may be that we're making a new history right now that we'll look back on, I hope, within 50 years to see that we are doing the right thing right now. And not looking back at an earlier history too much, but just so that we don't chop each other's heads off and blow up the world. I mean, we could do it all at once, but I think we're doing it one swipe at a time. So if we need to learn to stop whacking at ourselves, I don't know how to do that.
Right. Well, where this is going this week is, yesterday we tried to get a sense of this large story that God is doing and our piece in it. Today, trying to make the case that there is something awry about our species. And tomorrow I want to say that's really what the Old Testament and the New Testament are trying to address. And we're going to, through those lenses, do we maybe see some things a little differently in the Old Testament and New Testament. If we see that that's what God is trying to do. So that's where we're going. That's where we're going tomorrow. So we wrap up now. There is coffee, I guess. And is that upstairs today, or is it in the dining room?
It's in the dining hall all week. Sorry, there's no beanies.
And what part of the dining room?
You mean like if somebody's meeting for?
Wasn't there like a coffee hour now?
Yeah.
And I think I'm supposed to be there.
Oh, well, you can meet wherever you want. You can either, I think you are scheduled to be up. People could bring their coffee over and join you.
Oh, okay.
On Beanie's deck.
On this, right outside this door, there's a deck
upstairs.
If those who want to talk more about this or other things. Okay? Let's close with this benediction, the sending benediction. Would someone like to do the L part?
Go in peace into nature and human community.
Hold fast to what is good. Return evil to no one.
Make common cause with those who are oppressed.
Respect the scope of God's creation, always working honorably within nature's multi-layered ecosystems and species diversity.
Cherish life. But don't hoard life.
Above all, love the one who bestows every blessing.
May the peace of God, world maker, pain bearer, and love giver be upon us all.
Amen. Amen. Thank you for coming today.